The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters Today, November 7th, 2004. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And here, of course, on WILL AM 580. Today, excuse me, our guest is going to be Norman Solomon, a syndicated columnist on media and politics. Norman Solomon's weekly column, Media Beat, is distributed by Creator Syndicate and has been in national syndication since 1992. Norman Solomon is the founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, a national consortium of policy researchers and analysts. And I should say right at the outset that I am on the board of directors of the Institute for Public Accuracy, so there's a connection between the two of us. Norman Solomon is also a longtime associate of the media watchdog group FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. He's written 10 books on media criticism and corporate malfeasance. His latest book, which he discussed on the program last year, Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, which he co-authored with Reese Ehrlich and was published in 2003. Welcome to the airwaves of East Central Illinois, Norman.
Hi, Bob.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to join us.
My pleasure.
And let's just get right to the matter I think that a lot of our listeners are concerned with, and a lot of people in the United States and around the world are, which is the presidential election on Tuesday. Were you surprised by the outcome?
I was surprised after seeing reports on the exit polls, and for a few hours it seemed that Bush was going to lose. But up until Tuesday, it seemed to me to be kind of on a razor's edge.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was the story with these exit polls? Because it seemed like as of 4 or 5 in the afternoon, East Coast time, maybe even a bit later, all the exit polling data that was being leaked, without exception, was trending very favorably towards Kerry in every swing state. And then he won a couple of those swing states. But for the most part, the two crucial ones, Florida and Ohio, went several points in the other way soon thereafter. Do you have any sense of what the story was there?
Well, I think there were a number of factors. One is that the later waves of the exit polling data showed a tighter race in those crucial swing states than the initial one, which was released earlier, kind of mid-afternoon. And also, I think there was a kind of an undue faith in the precision of these exit polls. There is a margin of error with exit polling, as there is in public opinion polling. And so I think there was a multiplicity of factors. That said, I think a lot of people were very aware of just the structural inequities of the voting process itself, you know, the access to the voting machines, the kind of apparatus and technology that people in poor neighborhoods, African-American neighborhoods, might have access to, the inability of the electoral system to accommodate people on the basis of justice rather than frankly, structural bias. So, you know, what do those provisional ballots mean? People went in and voted. They may have told their exit pollers how they voted, but they were really set aside and not counted as the tallies came in.
Have the provisional ballots all been counted, do you know?
I don't know at this point. They certainly weren't at the time that the networks were reporting on Tuesday night and really didn't figure in the first 24 hours after the polls closed.
Well, let's talk, if we can, Norman Solomon, about the media coverage, the mainstream news media coverage of the campaign itself and in the months leading up to Election Day. You've written a bit about this. I mean, you're one of the top media observers in the country. Do you have some general comments you can make for our listeners?
Well, overall, I think it's really difficult to separate the quality of coverage of the campaigns from the overall focus and tenor and slant of media coverage generally. For instance, as we heard a few minutes ago in the interview with David Swanson from the AFL-CIO, there's just a tendency to downplay the importance of the working conditions and the income disparities that exist for people who go to work in this country. And that kind of bias that we whether we accept it or not, we have become familiar with, is infused in what is and isn't covered when it comes to a presidential campaign. I mean, nobody picks up the Chicago Tribune and says, where's the labor section? We accept there's going to be a business section every day. And that's kind of a parable for the way in which, unless candidates go way out of their way to hammer on issues of economic justice and what affects working people at an economic and working condition level, those sort of issues tend to just recede. And what we've gotten with some help, in this case from Osama bin Laden in the lead-up to the election a few days before, is a focus on what gets called national security and terrorism and so forth, and that is a kind of game that is played in the ball field of the powerful, those who are boosting the war in Iraq and more military spending. And there's no doubt that the predilection of the mass media is to go with that flow, to become more involved in kind of a fixation on issues of quote-unquote terrorism, and that is not beneficial to those who want to raise issues of, for instance, economic justice.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live today from Campbell Hall, the University of Illinois, here on WILL AM 580. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, the phone number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. What, as you were watching the last few weeks of the campaign, what were there... You know, it was striking to me that CBS announced after Rathergate that it would sort of bury a story it had done exposing the Bush administration on its activities prior to the Iraq War, trying to boost the claims of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I mean, what sort of stories do you think were out there for journalists to get that the American people didn't hear? I mean, legitimate, bona fide news stories that really dealt with the two candidates and the issues of this campaign.
Well, I think actually the retraction from Dan Rather and CBS about the George Bush military service story, the apparent forgery of documents, really was a turning point because, frankly, a lot of the networks were very skittish anyway about doing stories that would be tough on President Bush in the weeks and months before the November election. And this kind of tipped them over the edge. The momentum was moving after this Rathergate story in the other direction. They were running for cover. They were postponing stories. Even before that, CNN reporter Nick Robertson, as the Media Watch Group FAIR has reported, on September 10th, Nick Robertson said that there was a documentary coming up on CNN about Saudi Arabia, but he said, you know, we don't expect it until after the U.S. elections, and in fact, that's what took place. It apparently is scheduled just after the election and has not aired yet, even though it was apparently ready. Another would be that CBS decided to delay until after this election an investigative segment they'd done really questioning the Bush White House on this whole thing about the forged Niger uranium document.
That's what I was referring to.
Yeah, and they said, and this is a quote from the New York Times in late September, it would be inappropriate to air the report so close to the presidential election. So this is a case in point, but also part of a pattern. And I think this goes to the point of that unless themes and information is repeated and excavated and further explored, it's simply going to drop off the media radar screen and it's going to have appreciably less impact than themes and stories that are hammered on again and again, such as, is John Kerry a flip-flopper, such as, are the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth telling the truth or not?
Now, did they ever find out who was behind this Rathergate thing, this so-called forged memo or the forged memo?
No, but I have a theory about it.
Let's hear it.
You know, if you look at the really fine book, Bush's Brain, by James Moore and Wayne Slater, two really excellent reporters. Slater is with the Dallas Morning News, Austin bureau chief for that newspaper. You see an exhaustive book about Karl Rove, and you can't even call Rove a media strategist for the Bush White House because there's no blurring, there's no distinction, I should say, between media strategy and overall policy. You know, that's the basis upon which policy is made and implemented. And so Rove is just the key strategist in that sense. And when you look at the Bush's Brain book, which is now a film as well, you see now for decades Karl Rove, even before he hooked up with the Bush clan, has been involved in fabrications, in throwing as much mud as possible, whether documented or not, all kinds of strategies that he's implemented, pushing the envelope of legality. And you could say, just on the basis of the record, that Karl Rove does whatever he can get away with or thinks he can get away with. And the whole thing about the forged documents that Dan Rather went for really have a very Rove-like smell. And we may never find Rove's fingerprints on it, but we could say it's quite Rove-ish, even if not something that will ever be attached directly to him. You had Karl Rove as somebody who, according to the book, the evidence is strong, bugged his own office right before a key gubernatorial debate in Texas, and then called in the press immediately so a finger could be pointed at the opposition as doing the bugging. There also is the story of the biographer of George W. Bush, who was exposed as having a criminal record, and it turned out his documentation, which was damaging to Bush, was provided by Rove himself. So in other words, Rove found somebody who could be easily discredited to feed information that was out there and would probably emerge one way or another. So there is kind of a parallel there. I mean, there was a great vulnerability of George W. Bush on this story of him shirking his military service. You know, he wanted other people to fight and die in Vietnam. He was off not being willing to serve. And I think the net effect was that by giving forged documents to CBS, somebody basically poisoned the well for that story to the great benefit of the Bush campaign.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show coming to you on November 7th here on WILL AM 580. We do have open phone lines if you'd like to call in. The number 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Shelbyville, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yeah, and thank you very much for this program. I think the talk shows and the Clear Channel Radio with their 1,200 stations and the constant back and forth on whatever was about Switchboat veterans and the emphasis so much on this or that with that. And then when we come into the gay marriage bit, I was in Denver when that broke, and the Denver two papers, Rocky Mountain and the other one, both had fonts, about 24 or 25 font. And then there was just a very small thing about the Iraq War. And this continued the whole week I was there. Tremendous play on it. And then I think, again, Rush Limbaugh comes right in with what they want him to say. Now, do you think that this, with the Switchboat veterans, too, do you think this had a lot to do with this?
I think it had an enormous effect. It broke the momentum of the Kerry campaign in August, and it was able to resonate largely because there is an echo chamber that you alluded to that, forget about the left, even liberals don't have in this country in the news media. Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Fox News in general, The Wall Street Journal editorial page, The Washington Times, Weekly Standard. Something is able to percolate through that kind of media ground and then rises up, if you will, and the next thing you know, it's in the New York Times and on the major networks.
Yeah, if I can interject here, Norman, I mean, in the case of the Rathergate, I mean, this was, by all accounts that I can tell, sort of like a Mark Furman OJ situation, where if it was a forged document, it was plausible because the empirical record we have backs up the forgery.
Yeah.
In the case of Switchboats, this was a completely absurd story. It was discredited by all the documented evidence. Yet, as you point out, it remained alive and well. It really wasn't a huge ad buy either. It had this enormous echo chamber. And it wasn't simply conservative media, as you just pointed out. In fact, the Bill Maher show on HBO, which is, you know, the liberal show on the commercial media, in fact, had a big segment on it and interviewed the author, who, you know, was clearly just a partisan out to do damage to Kerry.
Yeah, absolutely. CNN, MSNBC, it was ricocheting all around. And the historical roots of this attack got very short shrift. The fact that John O'Neill, met with and was basically selected by the Nixon White House, that Charles Colson cultivated this guy, and then 3 decades later he pops up again basically in the same role and had, in terms of a functional relationship, the same kind of role with George W. Bush than he did with Richard Nixon.
Yeah, we're talking to Norman Solomon today, Media Matters. We've got the phone lines full. Please do call in. I make sure we get to all of you. 333-9455, toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, Champaign, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yes, I was wanting to ask about what I sense to be a kind of taboo that's developed in this last week after the elections regarding questioning the election results. There doesn't seem to be any effort in the mainstream media to take seriously problems that seem potentially to have occurred minimally in Ohio and Florida. And there are certain more underground outlets like Black Box Voting and Greg Palast's discussion on the web, as well as an article recently by Thomas, I think, Hartman, mm-hmm. in Common Dreams, in which he notes that Karen Hughes had told Bush that he'd lost that day. And that she was in tears and so on, at the time of the election. And so the difference between what even Bush himself was being told, as well as the exit polls, and then what happened eventually, makes one wonder about claims regarding the electronic voting machines, for example, that counties with 70% and sometimes 80% Democratic voters end up losing to Bush and so on. And so I'm not sure what to believe at this point, but there's a lot going on the internet right now, and in fact, John Conyers supposedly has sent a letter attempting to call for an investigation at the congressional level, which obviously won't happen given the Republican Congress. But issues like that, I wonder why the mainstream press, what I sense is a kind of tabooing of any kind of questioning of the election results. And this is, of course, after, as you were noting, all of these stories that were killed before the election, as well as, of course, Bush's using of a, I'm not sure what the word is, the thing on his back that he was using during the debates and so on, that was also killed. The story about that, I think it's CBS as well as The Post, if I recall correctly.
Times. Actually, the New York Times killed that
story. Oh, I'm sorry. New York Times, yeah.
You know, that's a great question. And if I can just add to what the caller mentions, Norman, I mean, I've been, and I think you have too, because you get email, been inundated with similar material. And a lot of it is coming from people like Greg Palast and Tom Hartman. And a number of others, John Conyers, who are not on the lunatic fringe, but who, in fact, are fairly credible sources raising empirically driven concerns. At the beginning of the show, you sort of you glossed over this and didn't seem to really want to dive into it. What's your take on all this?
Well, I don't think that really the cutting edge of this story is about the exit polling, which is what we were talking
okay.
about earlier. But I think there is a lot that needs to be looked into in terms of the way that the machines functioned, the way that the data has come out. And I think there is a good comparison that the caller made with this mysterious object at George W. Bush's back during the first presidential debate. And just to go through that quickly, the journalist Dave Lindorf did a piece on this in Salon on October 8th, and then something for MotherJones.com on October 30th, where he raised real questions about whether Bush basically broke the rules, was wired for sound to be coached during the first debate. And according to Lindorf, 5 days before this November 2nd election, the New York Times killed a story about that object, and that also, he said, two other major papers, the LA Times and the Washington Post, also consciously decided not to go into that story, which featured, according to Lindorf, a leading NASA scientist on satellite photo imaging. So that's kind of a more tangible, in a way, a definable story, and might be a metaphor as well for the more difficult question of, were the vote totals tampered with? And I think that the problem is looking at that in tandem with the question of who is even able to ostensibly cast a vote, and then what happens to the vote in terms of tallies. I think underlying it all is a fairly lackadaisical mass media approach for many, many months now about the fact that a lot of these votes on computerized systems would not be verifiable, wouldn't have a paper trail. Just a lot of blasé attitudes with not much more than rudimentary or rote stories when this should have caused an uproar months ago. Now this is exactly the situation we're in terms of Florida and Ohio. I think that Hartman and Palast are both raising important questions. It is on commondreams.org and elsewhere, and we ought to be demanding that the news media not simply slough it off, which is what they've done so far, but really look at the numbers, really do some investigation. In short, really do some journalism.
I mean, Palast has basically argued that Kerry won the election, that he actually carried Ohio, and other people have made similar arguments about New Mexico, although Ohio alone would get him over the goal line, were that the case. And, you know, it was interesting stuff on Election Day because you heard about these enormous lines, and almost always, from what I could tell, in heavily Democratic districts or traditionally Democratic districts, like in Cuyahoga County or in student districts in Ohio. And you never heard about enormously long lines in heavily Republican districts or rural districts, at least not that I reported on. Now, they might have happened, but I'd tell you what I saw reports about.
Yeah.
Yet then when the election came out, we were told that this massive outturn was people coming out to vote for Bush on religious grounds or on moral grounds. And it just seems to me that there's a factual disconnect at some point. Something's missing in the story so far.
Well, the data I've seen is that there was no unusually high right-wing evangelical vote compared to 4 years ago. The long lines have been touted by the news media as a sign of success of the Democratic process. I think they're a sign of failure, especially, as you point out, that they were overwhelmingly in the lower-income or African-American areas. Why should it be an endurance contest to wait in line literally for 2 or 4 or 6 hours to be able to vote? And that's something, again, we will never know how many people, because of other responsibilities, couldn't stay in line for all those hours and cast their vote.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today in Media Matters. We've got a full bank of callers, and we're going to get right back to the lines now. Line 2, Eureka, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Good afternoon. I enjoyed one of your books and your commentary. Two quick questions, and I'll get off the air. I guess I am cynical enough to think that Karl Rove may have had something to do with the misinformation that Dan Rather got. I wonder if you could comment on that. And two, I know it seems like a no-brainer. I realize it would probably be more of the same, but what effect do you think the election will have on the media landscape? Thank you.
Yeah, on the first point, as we were saying a little bit earlier, it does have a lot of earmarks of a Rove operation to basically poison a story that is a legitimate story by putting it out through a source that was impeachable. In terms of media, my fear is that based on history of the last few decades, the mass media love a winner. And you can bet that if Kerry had been declared the winner instead of Bush, there would be all kinds of, at least briefly, sycophant sort of stories about what a great visionary he was and his assistant Shrum and so forth. All that power is more gravitating more than ever towards Rove and Bush and Cheney. And we have to demand, I think, that the stenography and sycophant impulse that is so sustained in the mass media towards those who are in the White House be checked and reversed, because news media should be challenging the powerful, not licking their boots.
You're listening to Norman Solomon today, my guest on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. And we're going to go back to the phone lines. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hi. What I wanted to ask was, well, first of all, if what you're saying is true about the voting, and perhaps our whole history of voting, is that all of it would be called into question if we actually went and counted all the votes. And probably we should have a national holiday or two, at least 2 days for voting. I've always thought that we didn't really want everybody to vote, and that was the reason we don't have a holiday, as most other democracies do. What I really wanted to ask you about the media was the complete lack of any historical reporting on Vietnam with the Swift boats. I thought McNamara pretty much laid to rest that there was any good reason, any validity for going to Vietnam. But what I felt was that there was no coverage. I'm watching Dan Rather, who I assume is in his mid-60s. I'm at least 20 years younger than he is. And nothing was ever said. Why are we refighting the Vietnam War? I thought this was laid to rest. Could you discuss that a little bit? Thank you.
Well, yeah, on the first point, the fact that we don't have a day off, you know, the Constitution says it's the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. Okay, that might be in stone, but everybody should have a day off. And the news media almost never have raised this question of the economic class bias that some people can more easily take time off from their workday, and a lot of people who are hourly workers, who are working class folks, it's much more of a strain, and this is a disincentive and a pressure against having a participation throughout the society to vote. Clearly, the status quo benefits the interests of large corporations and the right wing. When you look at Vietnam, I mean, I really cringe every time I hear about the quagmire in Iraq, because the term quagmire presumes that the problem is the failure to win, and then takes off the table the justice of the war to begin with, there is a strong case that can be made and should be made that the problem with this war is not that the United States can't win it, although that's a practical problem, but that the war was and is based on lies and therefore is illegitimate. And until we can compel the news media to widen the debate, we will be in this tactical morass, one might say tactical quagmire of media coverage, which then just simply focuses on the military options in tandem with political moves. I'd say one other thing. This attack on Fallujah is, by any standards of civilized warfare, even if you don't think that is an oxymoron, by civilized warfare, this is an atrocity that is underway.
Yeah, go a little bit more into that, if you would, Norman, for some of our listeners who might have been not tuning into media for the last 4 days for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, the United States is proceeding with a massive attack on the city of Fallujah. And I'd recommend to anybody who can go to the web, take a look at an article by Rahul Mahajan, who has written a piece that's on commondreams.org right now, and he was in Fallujah in April and describes in detail what it was like to see children bleeding, taken into a clinic, and then you compare his account to what happened in April, which what is taking place right now. The U.S., a long-planned assault, timed to take place after the U.S. election, trying to defeat the quote-unquote insurgents, but in the process killing, I would say, by scope of what is planned, many hundreds, probably thousands of civilians. They've already blown up a hospital in the last 48 hours. And I'm sorry to say, this is just the beginning of our tax dollars at work in Fallujah.
You know, what was striking during the presidential campaign was that the war in Iraq really was not an issue except in really sort of a management level. Who can better organize the war to be successful of the two candidates, rather than sort of the fundamental question of whether it was a justifiable war, the issues you're trying to raise. Does that exonerate the media? They say, look, John Kerry wasn't criticizing the basis of the war, so if no one running for office is criticizing it, it's not really up to us to raise that issue?
No, I think that simply parroting the lines of attack that have come from the major presidential candidates is no excuse at all for the mass media. I mean, we're told that journalism is the first draft of history, and we're brought up to kind of be horrified at the idea that history would be falsified, and yet it's being falsified all the time, often by omission. You know, Aldous Huxley, in his introduction to Brave New World, said that lies are powerful, but even more powerful is silence about truth. And the news media silence about bringing up the roots of this war, the basis upon which it has been sold and perpetrated, really is a form of profound dishonest propaganda. And one other thing I'd mention is that if you go back and you look at some of the most incisive coverage of the war in Vietnam, you find I.F. Stone, who wrote that it would be impossible, this was in 1969, impossible to get, as he put it, enough Asians to kill Asians to make the U.S. strategy in Vietnam possible. Now we could say it's going to be impossible to find enough Arabs to kill Arabs to make the White House strategy viable. And the reason it's impossible to achieve that sort of a goal, the Iraqization of the war, is that this is an imperial venture and there's no legitimacy, and the United States has not embarked on a democratic project in Iraq, quite the opposite.
You know, it's, on Friday night on the Bill Maher Show, and I'm not here to tout that show, but I happen to watch it because it is sort of the most liberal show available politically in the commercial media, and it touts itself as that. It had as a guest Noam Chomsky for a brief interview, and Chomsky mentioned that the Iraq War violated the Nuremberg Convention, and that by the because it was an attack on another country, and by the Nuremberg Convention, the U.S. is accountable for everything that happens after that. I mean, it's these are war crimes, he says, and I think he would describe them, what's going on in Fallujah, as a war crime. And the response was interesting because Andrew Sullivan, former editor of the New Republic, was on the panel that sort of talked after Chomsky left. And he just went absolutely insane over this. I mean, he was screaming and yelling about how illegitimate it was to have someone who hates America and loves the Soviet Union on the air, even making these crazy accusations.
Yeah, this is someone, Andrew Sullivan, who's quite a media favorite, who right after 9/11 accused those of us who were challenging U.S. foreign policy as being what he called a fifth column. And so, you know, McCarthyism is not dead at all. It's really being perpetrated now in a different form.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Norman is the author of a weekly column, Media Beat, distributed by Creator Syndicate. And you can find that column, I assume, Norman, at your website, normansolomon.com.
That's right.
And he's also the founder and executive director of Institute for Public Accuracy, which you can find on the web. It's a very valuable website at www.accuracy.org. We have a full bank of callers, and I promise I'll get to all of you. Let's go back to the lines right now. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hello, Norman.
Hi.
It's nice to engage you. The engineer says I can't, so I'll just ask the questions. It was nice to hear you bring up I.F. Stone. Now, let's not forget that Phil Oakes wrote the song, Love Me, I'm a Liberal, all about Phil Oakes, or about I.F. Stone in the 60s. But the question I want to ask is that what do you think the specific gravity is of the unholy alliance between the homosexuals and the Christian neo-fascists in this election? It's rather severe, I think. And I'll hang up and let you go.
That was kind of cryptic. I don't really think Phil Oakes wrote his song, Love Me, I'm a Liberal, about I.F. Stone.
Yeah, I've heard that song a few thousand times, and that wouldn't have occurred to me.
Yeah. In terms of an alliance, I mean, if I'm understanding the question right, you know, there are reactionary and racist and xenophobic movements that thrive on opposing an upsurge for social justice. And, you know, one could say that the civil rights movement caused an alliance with the KKK. I don't think so. You know, you're going to have reaction. You're going to have people who thrive. And the Southern strategy of the Republican Party developed at the end of the 1960s and into the 70s, in a sense, thrived on racism and also thrived on the fact that there was progress for social justice and civil rights. So I think if I'm understanding the question right, I would reject the premise.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, San Francisco, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hey, I agree with everything that Norman Solomon is saying about Bush, and I believe Rove had something to do with a lot of the outcome, and I do believe that Kerry could have won had they insisted on going back and counting the votes and making sure that they were honest in the elections. But I feel like I'm impelled to call because I believe that many of us who were opposed to Bush need to look at the mote in our own eye. Looking back, I believe that the group that supported Kerry failed to stand up for how the Democrats harassed and went after Nader during the election year. They did not. The media didn't cover it. They mostly laughed it off, and they didn't look at how the Green Party split at its convention and how, or examine how Cobb was nominated. I listened to Mr. Solomon debate Kevin Zeese on Democracy Now, and I've got to tell you, Mr. Solomon, you put up a very strong argument, a good argument, for your views, and I'm really don't differ in against them as much as saying that I think maybe it was a mistake, and I don't know whether it was or wasn't. I'm sincerely hoping that all people who are opposed to this regime that is so illegal, Machiavellian, will unite, and maybe whether they agreed with or liked Nader or not, they will realize that power concedes nothing without a demand, and the time for demands are now. I wonder if you comment.
Yeah, well, thanks for your comments. First, when you look at Ohio and Florida, one of the striking things, which is kind of hidden in plain sight, is that they're operating like a banana republic in the sense that there is so much power over the entire election process, from registration to vote counting, four partisan officials, Ken Blackwell in Ohio, Jeb Bush and his appointees in Florida, and that's just not the way things should run. I mean, the inspectors monitors from other countries are aghast that you have partisan people in charge of adjudicating and running the election process. In terms of the moats in our own eyes, it's something we should always, you know, look at. We always have flaws in how people who are trying to create social change function. And on the one hand, I think that we should always support people's right to run for office and right to be heard. At the same time, to challenge the wisdom of doing so is not the same as challenging the right to do so. And in the case of Ralph Nader running or anything else, I think those are important distinctions to try to keep clear.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a little under 20 minutes left. If you'd like to call in and speak with Norman, the number is 333-9455, and our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yes, hello. There's 2 points I wanted to make. One was in regards to this bulge in the back of Bush's coat during the debate. My understanding is the NASA scientist who had come out to enhance that image and was claiming that it was a receiver of some kind. You have to understand that he would be an expert in image processing, and what you really want to do is talk to someone who's an expert in wireless transport. And we've had the capability for at least a decade to have a system where you'd be able to receive information, video, audio, whatever, in an environment like that without having to have some imposing thing back there. You could have something very small that would fit actually within a belt or something. So the story is completely ridiculous in a way. And I thought about it myself and thought, well, it could have been a bulletproof jacket or a back brace or something. But the other point that's really more important is that you had seemed to gloss over the exit poll issue the second time as well. And maybe that's because you haven't seen the emerging evidence yet. But if you look at a website called ustogether.org, it's a nonprofit group which has done a county-by-county analysis of Florida election results. And they've shown that contrary to everything coming out in the mass media, contrary even to the story on Free Press's own website, that they have shown that exit polls may have been surprisingly accurate in Florida. And this is where the discrepancy is. Smaller Democratic-dominated counties which used optical scanning equipment, that is counties, say, under 20,000 people, which use optical scanning, not electronic voting, have results which seem to be flipped. That is, a county such as Baker County, which is 69% Democratic and 24% Republican registered, instead would have results that would come out 7,700 Republican votes versus 2,100 Democratic votes. And so what you find is these smaller Democratic-dominated counties with optical scanning equipment, the results are often looked as if they're flipped. And all across the board, you can see this in these smaller Democratic-dominated counties. If you remove these from and recalculate the results, then you get something that's within, like, under a percent accuracy to what the exit poll says. So I'm not sure if you've seen that yet. This is just, a lot of this stuff is just coming out. But I think that story is huge.
You're talking about election results here, not exit polls.
Well, no, actually, I think what he's doing, unfortunately he's not on the line anymore, but I've seen the same data, Norman. I think it correlates it shows there's a discrepancy. The discrepancy in the exit polls is most striking in these counties.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it links it up to registration and to voter output.
But what I'm saying is that what I've seen is that what's most suspicious about it is the actual vote totals that have come in and what we know about those counties and the registration, am I right?
Okay.
And I guess I'm a little bit leery of us putting front and center as the kind of the centerpiece of the argument, the exit polls, because the later versions of the exit polls were a matter of a percent or two,
mm-hmm.
and I'm worried about pinning it on that. I think a data analysis of the actual vote totals is much more, to me,
yeah.
much more compelling.
And I think you're right. I think that what he was talking about was more about the actual vote totals. But I think what that suggests then is that exit polls which showed Kerry ahead might be defensible if the vote is switched in these smaller counties, because the actual vote then will be – there will be a discrepancy, won't because the exit polls are wrong, but because the way the votes are tallied was wrong.
Yeah, that could be. There's also a lot of talk about the Zogby polls, which were not exit polls. They were the final opinion poll that was released 5 p.m. Eastern on Election Day. And in fact, it's curious because in Ohio, he had a notation of Bush being up by two, yet he called it, quote, trending Kerry, unquote, and gave the electoral votes to Kerry in Ohio. Likewise, in Florida, he had it at 0.1% Kerry up, trending Kerry. Well, these are razor thin. I think in both the election results, the honesty of the election results, and for that matter, the bulge issue, what we should be demanding is thorough journalism, not that we know the exact answer, but that we are demanding that news media stop simply eliding the whole question.
Yeah, I quite agree. But one thing about the exit polls, I want to return to this because I agree we shouldn't, it's not right to hang everything on this. So if that's proven to be that those are flawed, therefore the case collapse, it's sort of like Rathergate killing that discussion. But at the same time, you know, until 2000, exit polls have been, as everyone has acknowledged, sort of the gold standard of polling because you're getting actual voters coming right out of the booth. And the honesty level has historically been astronomically high. And that, you know, the whole discussion in our for the last 30 years has been because these things are so accurate and so powerful that they know who wins the election before votes are counted. And the West Coast would never have any incentive to vote because before you get off work in the West Coast, they tell you that Reagan has won or Carter or Clinton or whoever. And because these, it's been acknowledged how powerful these are. Now, suddenly, in the last 4 years, these have gone from being these gold standard polls to being these clunkers where they're like throwing at a dartboard.
Well, I think you make a good point. I think just a caveat at the same time is that there's got to be a margin of error.
Granted, there's a margin of error, but my understanding in the past has been because they can systematically pick people in a way you can't do in a normal poll by actually going to the poll and getting the actual voters in key precincts and weighting it with old things. Those things, the margin of error has been as low as you can possibly make it. And, you know, the batting average has been like 100% until Florida in 2000. And there, I think there's evidence that the exit polls may well have been accurate.
Oh, I think that's actually a very strong case that what was inaccurate was the way votes were counted.
And so, I don't know enough about how the exit polls were done this year, and you don't either, and so we don't want to hang our hat on this. But I don't think it's an irrational response to say, well, maybe the exit polls, you know, unless they were for the first time in 30 years were done by morons, might have more truth to them than we've generally ascribed so far.
Well, this ought to be a huge national media focus right now.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yes. I just want to give my impression, listening to this program and to you guys, both of you, that it seems to me that you're rather in denial. That is, Bush won. I live in a district in Urbana that won 70% for Kerry, but Bush won nationally. And you're trying to excuse it or explain it away or have Machiavellian schemes about Karl Rove, planted stories and all kinds of things to avoid the truth. Bush won. I'll get off.
Well, I don't think these are either-or questions necessarily. I mean, are we to then suspend all critical faculties because quote-unquote, Bush won, that Karl Rove doesn't have this history that is laid out in detail in the Bush's Brain book. We just go on faith that the winner is pure as the driven snow. I mean, that makes no sense to me.
Let's follow up on that, though, with the way that since the election, there's been a discussion now about the mandate, what the election means. Because as the caller points out, Bush won. It was in some quarters, it's been called a landslide. But in most quarters, it's considered and accepted, even in Democratic circles, as a mandate of sorts for the Bush agenda. And the media have made a good bit about this. You know, one of the things that's interesting in the research on elections is that, and there's been a lot of research on this, is that the discussion of what the election means and an interpretation of it always starts after the election. And the people who win the election always try to use it as an opportunity to say, this election justifies what I want to do. And oftentimes, there's not much connection between what voters were talking about before the election and what the mandate is said to mean after the election.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And 4 years ago, even though he got 500,000 fewer votes than Gore, the Bush people immediately said that it showed how Bush was more in tune with the American people, which, you know, was on its face silly. We've in the last 96 hours or so had this cascading effect first coming, of course, from the Bush campaign in the White House. This mandate idea, and, you know, FAIR, the Media Watch group that I'm associated with, put out a release on Friday, Media Advisory Defining Bush's Mandate. People can find it at FAIR.org on the web. They have quotes from the Boston Globe, LA Times, USA Today. Chris Matthews, who was not friendly towards Bush this time around, clearly leaning towards Kerry, he announced at the top of his broadcast Wednesday night, President Bush wins the majority of the vote and a mandate for a second term. One more example on NPR, Renee Montagne on Wednesday said, and I'm quoting, "The president's people are calling this a mandate. By any definition, I think you could call this a mandate," unquote. Well, that's preposterous. By many definitions, you could call a 51-48% victory anything but a mandate.
Yeah, and one of the issues that's been part of the mandate that the Bush administration's put forward has been the privatization, or I don't know what the exact term is, the reorganization of Social Security.
Yeah.
And during the presidential debates, Bush went to great lengths to assure people he wouldn't monkey with Social Security, that he shouldn't lose votes in that ground. And yet, immediately after the election, it seems like that's the first thing they said they've got a mandate to do.
It's kind of a flip over of bait and switch. It's to not bait and then switch it over and say, this is what you bought. I think we're going to get a strong push from that, given the composition of the Senate. And, of course, it will be euphemized as something else, like individual savings accounts.
We're talking to Norman Solomon. We've got a couple callers who have been very patient. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, Farina, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yeah, hi. I heard Ramsey Clark in a talk, in a the Million Worker March call for the impeachment of Bush. And I've heard him mention this before, that he's written the articles, and he just needs someone in the Congress or Senate to submit them, and he can't get anyone. Any thoughts on that? And also, was Kerry asked to concede prematurely? I thought that was awfully quick, especially when Edwards came right up behind him and said, we're going to count every vote. What was that about?
Yeah, I think it was too quick. I think,
why do you think he did it? I mean, because it was such a big deal that they were going to make sure they got the vote right, even if it took a few days, to get these provisional votes counted, to get all the sort of inconsistencies ironed out so the people of the country could be confident that it was a fair vote. Why do you think he threw in the towel before the provisional ballots were dealt with?
Well, there's so much internalized pressure to say after the election we all need to unify. And I said in an interview right afterwards, I thought it was very wrong how Kerry said that it was time now for unity. Unity against somebody who's going to try to pack the Supreme Court with theologic right-wing ideologues, for instance, just makes no sense to me. And I think it's of a piece of the same attitude that is not replicated at the grassroots. I think the vast majority of people, and this is shown by polls, who voted for Kerry have told pollsters since then they're upset with the result, and we're not ready for unity at all. We want to fight ahead on principle.
In the first part of that question, Norman, did you catch that?
Oh, yes. I have great respect, for instance, for Francis Boyle, the law professor who has pursued questions.
Yeah, right here at the University of Illinois.
Yeah, he's a terrific person, scholar, and advocate. Politically, it's really hard for me to see where this goes unless one can develop all kinds of new information that would be persuasive to the public at large. And you got to figure, if you can't get a majority of people on November 2nd to vote against Bush, you're not going to have public support for impeachment unless you really add something new and dramatic to the mix.
Yeah, I certainly couldn't imagine the press jumping on this bandwagon unless there was the equivalent of a factual atom bomb that goes off.
Yeah.
We're talking to Norman Solomon today. We've got time for one more caller. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hello. Yes, you've touched on what I wanted to ask about. The previous caller who has said Bush won, and then that's it, and it's time to accept it. There seem to be questions about how he won it. You could almost say the same thing, I think, in 1933. Adolf Hitler won. That's it. Let's accept it. And you can see where that kind of acceptance leads.
Yeah.
Do you think there's anything that can be done about making these new electronic voting machines more accountable, leaving a paper trail?
Well, for a fraction of the Pentagon budget, you could have nationally uniform voting machines that had a paper trail. And clearly there's a desire not to do this. And that goes to your point about legitimacy. I mean, 4 years ago, with a minority of the votes, and I think it's fair to say, a stolen election in Florida, there was the claim made that Bush's presidency was legitimate. Now people who claimed it was legitimate 4 years ago are telling us now finally his second term will be legitimate. I think the point is that underlying it all, we have a structure of media and political institutions that mitigate against genuine democracy. We don't have genuine democracy. Poor people have so much less power than the affluent, for instance. And so to be cognizant of that is to sweep off the board this question of legitimacy and to bring up the matter of how we're going to create true democracy, which entails fighting tooth and nail against this administration.
You know, Norman, we've only got a minute or two left, but I do want to ask you before we leave, you know, the big debate that's coming up now already in the news media and the op-ed pages, the New York Times have had several columns about this, and it's been all over the press. It's been, where does the Democratic Party go now at the national level? And the range of debate extends from Tom Frank's op-ed saying it needs to become much more populist and class-oriented to Nicholas Kristof's argument that it needs to move rightward, become much more in tune with what the Republicans are doing, be seen as less combative, less liberal, to appeal to those voters that clearly are not voting for it at present. What's your take on this debate?
I find what Tom Frank is saying to be quite compelling, and I think that Nicholas Kristof's piece yesterday, I think it was, made no sense to me. It was almost a parody of watering down principles, and I don't think it's particularly effective. I mean, you can win and lose, in a sense. To look at Tony Blair, who has been warlike, who has based this war in Iraq on lies, and say we want that kind of Labor Party, is certainly totally unappealing. And basically, both at the level of principle and at the level of even winning, I think this notion to make the Democratic Party simply GOP light makes no sense at all to me.
Now, 4 years ago, I know you supported Nader's campaign, if I recall correctly.
Right.
And
yeah.
This year, you were against Nader getting involved. You did not support that.
Right.
What's your sense at the national level, at least, of the prospects of a third party being a legitimate challenger for progressives to organize? Or do you think it's got to be the Democrats?
I think that the prospects for a third party are very bleak. We're dealing with an administration that has some fascistic tendencies and may move more in a fascistic direction. Those are not good conditions for a third party to run national candidates. What I support is kind of an inside-outside approach where we have an independent progressive movement that's not part of the Democratic Party, but recognizes the need to fight the right. And I think as a practical matter, you don't do that with a campaign such as Nader's, which in the states where he got on the ballot last Tuesday got less than 1% of the vote. There's a reason why that's the case.
On that note, Norman, I hear the band tuning up, which means I've got to clear out of the studio. I want to thank you, Norman Solomon, for being our guest today. Norman Solomon writes the weekly column Media Beat. You can find out about him at www.normansolomon.com or go to www.accuracy.org. My name's Bob McChesney. I'm your host. I'll be back in 167 hours with Tariq Ali, a tape show we did just before the election. Norman, thanks again for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Bob.
And I want to thank Victor Picard, my producer, for doing a phenomenal job, as always. And God bless you all in the new age of America.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Devro TPAC in Danville, Dick's Pharmacy, Arthur, EAGCO Incorporated, Fairmont, and Citizen Sandwich and Convenience, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Tonight at 8 on WILL-TV, Masterpiece Theater presents Henry VIII, a dazzling new costume drama about the monarch who married six times, founded a new church, and presided over a bloodbath. Masterpiece Theater tonight at 8 Central Time on our companion station WILL-TV, PBS for Central Illinois. This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny with a high 60 to 65 degrees and north winds 15 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly clear with a low around 30 degrees and north winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a high in the upper 40s and north winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana.